Good afternoon. This afternoon's case is United States versus Finch. I see counsel has made it. Counsel for the appellant are ready to argue? Counsel for the government?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Counsel for the appellant may argue.
I was almost going to instinctively say good morning, members of the court, but good afternoon, members of the court. It is always a pleasure to be here. My name is William Casera, and along with Captain Stephen Dre, we represent the appellant in this case, David Finch. The issue in this case is that the military judge erred when he admitted AH's entire recorded statement to CID, as it was not a prior consistent statement under MRE 801 D1 Bravo. This court knows, the standard of review is for abuse of discretion under U.S. v. Frost, and that deference is warranted where the military judge places his or her analysis on the record and application of the law to the facts. There is less deference accorded when the military judge fails to do so. The facts in this case are fairly straightforward in the sense that the trial counsel sought to admit Prosecution Exhibit 3, a video of an hour and 42-minute long recorded CID interview of the alleged victim, A.H. The defense objected, citing massive amounts of hearsay, that it was repetitive, and that it was cumulative, and argued that it was, merely repetitive of A.H.'s testimony. The military judge, without reviewing the video, admitted it in its entirety, without discussing the specific requirements of 801 D1B. As the court knows, under 801 D1B, a statement is not hearsay if it is consistent with the declarant's testimony and is offered for one of two reasons: to either A, 1, rebut an express or implied charge of a recent fabrication or improper influence or motive in so testifying, or 2, to rehabilitate the declarant's credibility as a witness when attacked on another ground.
When they say rehabilitate a witness's credibility, what does that mean?
I would argue that what it means is a witness's credibility, for example, could be attacked on the grounds that she was intoxicated, and that you are allowed to then put in a prior statement or prior evidence that she was not intoxicated as to how much alcohol she may have had to drink.
I mean, the fact that it's a broader phrasing than the other subsection, does that change the need to be able to tie the attack on the credibility to the prior consistent statement? Do you understand my question?
I think I do, Judge. And I think that...
So, for example, if the attack on the credibility is, you're saying this today, but it wasn't in your CID statement, right? And if the statement, the prior statement, in fact shows that was not said to CID, is that helping the credibility?
No, that does not rehabilitate the witness. Certainly evidence that shows that, contrary to the questioning at some other part in the interview, for example, that she had said that, then that would rehabilitate the witness. But if the defense, if the alleged victim or the witness says X and Y, and defense counsel says, well, you didn't say Z when you talked to CID, putting on the CID statement that says she said X and Y but not Z does not rehabilitate her. It is merely repetitive of what she said on the witness stand, and that is what this court says you cannot do under U.S. v. Frost. Under MRA, under subsection 1, the recent fabrication, the prior statements of AH are inadmissible because every statement in the video was made after the motive to fabricate arose. And that's the McCaskey case, which looks at the timing requirement.
Counsel, on that particular point, in the government's brief, the government suggests, or the government reads the record as the trial defense counsel asserting not one, not two, but at least three different motivations to fabricate. And the third one of those was that she wanted to live with her friend right now, which would be different from the earlier ones that she wanted to get away from Dave and that she didn't like her mother. But the third one was being, well, now she wants to live with her friend. And that motive would seem to have arisen after the statement was made to CID.
Your Honor, I would have two responses to that. The first one is, when you look at motive, I think it's important for the court to consider that, in essence, there was one motive here. She wanted Dave out of the house, or she wanted Dave out of her life. She wanted to live somewhere else. And, in fact, in her interview statement to CID, she said, I still feel that way. In other words, I had this belief before, this motive before, and I have this motive now. So I think that those three, as you called it, motives are really subsections, for lack of a better term, of the larger motive of wanting to live away from the appellant. But I think the more important fact of that, Judge, is even if this court were to rule, and I've learned after 30-some-odd years that occasionally the court doesn't agree with me on every point, even if this court were to rule that those are prior, that is a prior consistent statement, then certainly, maybe, you know, then from the video, that statement may come in as substantive evidence. That does not mean that an hour and 42-minute long interview in which she discusses a myriad of other things, and an hour and 35 minutes worth of which is not prior consistent statements, should have been admitted in its entirety. And the military judge as the gatekeeper had the responsibility of saying, that's not coming in its entirety. If you wish to excise out and show me which statements are admissible, for example, to say that she had a, you know, that is consistent with her prior testimony, that's fine. But that's not what happened.
On that point, in looking at the statements, some are largely consistent, some seem to be just off the mark, and some seem to be inconsistent. And one example of one that was inconsistent was that she said she was sore after the alleged assault, but didn't say that at trial. And my question is, in what way were any of these, what would you say were the most prejudicial, and why are they prejudicial in the sense that they, in a judge-alone trial, that they would have affected the result or affected trial strategy or whatever they might have done? Which ones do you think were most prejudicial?
Of the prior inconsistent statements or of anything that
wasn't
anything
that was admitted? Yeah, I mean, the prior consistent statements, assume that we get past that first hurdle of whether the consistent statements can come in. I'm talking mostly about the inconsistent statements, which I agree couldn't come in, but which would be the most prejudicial, and why were they prejudicial?
I would say of the inadmissible statements, the most prejudicial were the statements that A.H.'s, and it was sort of third-hand testimony when she said in the CID interview, my mother said that when I have friends staying over the house, David can't be at the house, and that the one time that David was at the house, my mom told him, again, third-hand hearsay, well, don't go into their room, don't mess with them. I would argue that those two statements are about as prejudicial as you can get because, A, they're bolstering, B, they're improper character evidence. And when the military judge, you know, Judge, you make a great point when you say this was a judge-alone trial, so when the military judge tells us, I will apply the proper weight to these, well, the rule says that he can consider these as substantive evidence. We have every reason to take the military judge at his word and say that he considered as substantive evidence that A.H.'s mother said that when he has children spending the night at the house, he needs to go somewhere else.
Mr.
And I would
Cassera,
argue that that's the most damaging, Judge.
Mr. Cassera,
yes,
isn't the judge presumed to know what he can and cannot consider specifically with regard to hearsay? I mean, the judge has been to law school, hasn't he? He knows what hearsay is. He knows he can't consider that. So why isn't he presumed to have not considered it? Your issue seems to be twofold. Number one, he considered it all, but number two, he didn't come back and tell us what he did and didn't consider. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I would have two responses. Again, Judge, I think this is my day for twos. First off, I've been to law school. I'm going to try and understand all of the hearsay rules. But besides that...
No, you're not a judge.
But besides that, Your Honor, I go back to the simple fact that the military judge, first off, he admitted this evidence before he ever heard it. Okay, so I think that he gets less deference in terms of, quote, knowing the law when he admits evidence that he hasn't even reviewed.
But at some point he's going to go back and look at it, right?
Yes, and say...
And in a member's trial, it might make sense not to do that. But in Judge Lone trial, I mean, he's probably not going to spend a whole hour and 40 minutes and then come back, is he?
Well, I think he should. I think, if you're asking me, Judge, I'll answer your other question in a second, but if you're asking me what the military judge should have done, is he should have said, no, the entire video is not admissible. Trial counsel, you go back and tell me which parts you wish to admit. But in terms of your other question, Your Honor.
Once he has looked at it and decided what he's going to consider and what he's not going to consider? He should come back on the record.
Well, then I would take him at his word when he says, I will give it the weight that it's considered, when the rule says that you can consider this as substantive evidence. I think that we have every reason, again, to believe that the military judge did exactly what he said he was going to do and consider this evidence, this interview.
It does seem as though the military judge, I mean, he or she obviously did admit the statement in toto without having looked at it and made the sort of sweeping statement, I find it is admissible under MRE 801. So I don't disagree necessarily with your suggestion that this military judge did not appear to actually know the law with respect to 801. But nonetheless, in terms of the prejudice, right, where's the prejudice? Is it those two statements that you...
No, there's certainly more, Your Honor, and I can go through them.
And I have another question that you can address now or on rebuttal, which is, you know, because we haven't looked at this rule before, and it's a fairly broad statement about the credibility, whenever the credibility has been drawn into question, or whatever the exact language is. In your view, with what particularity does a government need to line up? So, for example, the credibility was attacked in this way, right, and this specific prior consistent statement, but this prior statement rehabilitates him. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, how closely does that need to be, does that line need to be?
I would argue it has to be fairly narrowly construed, and it has to be fairly close, because if otherwise, Your Honor, what we're going to wind up with is this, okay? To take the government's argument to its somewhat illogical, and I don't mean that in their sense being illogical, but to take it to my illogical absurdity would be that, A, the defense counsel cannot cross-examine the victim at all, because if they do, then they are calling their credibility into question. And B, if they are questioned at all, then regardless of what the alleged victim says, we can put in their entire forensic interview, and we don't need to worry about the rest of the trial. And at that point, you're getting into a confrontation issue.
Because, I mean, here, and basically the government says, her credibility has been attacked, the timeline's been attacked, they talked to other witnesses about the timeline, her credibility has been attacked, her memory has been attacked, and so we get to put the whole statement in. Right.
I
mean, that's what they did.
That's what they did. I'm not sure what your follow-up question is.
Yeah, no, I'm just troubled by the case, right?
Which is
the whole line of questioning of, well, you said this today, but you didn't say it then, and you were given the opportunity. I mean, that's classic cross-examination. And my concern is that this new rule not be a way to drive a truck through the hearsay rule.
Well, I think that's why I believe it was either Frost or the Army Court in Adams said that this needs to be done on a case-by-case basis. At least for now, I would argue, until, you know, somebody else takes a look at the rule and says, or until this court says, this is not an opportunity to drive a semi through. It's an opportunity to throw pinpricks at it and say, this statement should not have come in, or rather, this statement is consistent, so it should come in, but the rest of this does not. Judge Olson, did you have a question? Chief Judge does. Thank you.
In the interest of driving a pickup through it, where does the sealed testimony of Dr. Terry Thomas or Thomas Taylor, Thomas Taylor come in, and how duplicative of what this came in, how duplicative is it? I mean, it seems to me that if it came in any way under her ambit, then how can you argue there's prejudice, regardless of what happened with this other stuff?
Well, because I don't think Dr. Thomas Taylor discussed things such as the zipper, which, you know, in answer to Judge Meg's question, was probably the second most damning question about all of this, that, you know, something that she did not discuss at all at trial, but discussed in great detail in her CID statement. Something such as the statements, the third-hand hearsay testimony of Mom, about statements by Mom as to when other children spend the night. None of that came in through Dr. Thomas Taylor. But again, Your Honor, you know, I think it's important for the court to consider in my last minute, the question here isn't, was some of this admissible? We would argue it wasn't, but even if the court says some of it was, that's not the issue. The issue is that there's an hour and 42 minutes, the large majority of which is not admissible.
Well, yeah, what you're saying is there are substantial differences between Thomas Taylor's stuff and the stuff at issue.
That's the idea. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Counsel, on rebuttal, could you, if you're able to, identify a case where this court or the Supreme Court or any court has held that the normal deference given to a military judge's understanding of the law is eviscerated when there's evidence that they did not, in fact, understand the law?
I don't have Westlaw handy, Judge, but I will certainly do my best. I don't think the court has wireless signal, but I will do my best, Your Honor.
Counsel, may I ask one question? I think you may have already answered this, but if the military judge had followed regular procedures and had reviewed the entire video or reviewed portions of it, which would seem like the government could have identified, but had reviewed the entire video and then decided that only some parts were admissible, he still would have seen the entire video. But I think it's your position that it's not just that he saw the entire video, it's that he admitted the entire video.
Absolutely.
And that because he said, I will follow the rules, that meant that he said he would use it all substantively.
Absolutely, Judge. And if a quick analogy in 10 seconds, Judge. You know, the rule used to be, as you know, that if a judge saw the quantum, we still presume the military judge is going to do what the military judge is supposed to do. The fact that he saw something in and of itself is not the issue. It's the fact that he admitted it and said that he would consider it substantively. Thank you, members of the court. Subject to any further questions, I will return.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Brian Jones. Major Craig Shapiro and I represent the United States. The sole defense strategy employed in this case was a multifaceted, broadside attack on AH's credibility. When this trial strategy is selected, a defense counsel reaps what they sow. By charging AH with testifying under an improper motivation and recent fabrication, defense counsel opened the door to the admission of Prosecution Exhibit 3 under MRE 801 Delta 1 Bravo Part 1.
So you disagree that the government needed to tie specifics with the credibility challenges to specifics in the video?
I do not disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the federal common law that's developed around the admissibility of rehabilitative statements, I think, generally stands for the government must fortify the credibility at the point of attack. And turning directly to Part 2, I disagree with appellant's counsel that it's our position that any cross-examination of a witness will automatically open the door to prior consistent statements.
And yet that's what the trial counsel in this case said, right, which is her credibility has been attacked, therefore the video comes in.
Well, Your Honor.
So it was a fairly broad sweeping statement, wasn't it?
It was a broad sweeping statement, Your Honor. And in this case, what the two examples provided by the drafters are the elicitation of inconsistent statements and attacks on a witness's memory. And if just jumping directly into Part 2 of the rule, I can link this up for the court and just connect the dots on one clear line of attack in this case. Of a fact of central importance to the court-martial was how many instances of abuse were there? Was there two instances, were there one, or were there none at all? Now, the government charged two distinct examples. AH testified to two distinct instances of abuse that occurred at Montlake. The defense counsel cross-examined AH and pinned her down on the fact that she told her mother, SF, about only one instance of abuse. The defense counsel did the same thing in the cross-examination of AC, eliciting from AC a prior inconsistent statement of AH that she'd only told her friend AC about one instance of abuse. Prosecution Exhibit 3, where AH clearly discusses two instances of sexual assault at Montlake, consistent with her trial testimony, therefore directly fortifies at the point of attack on that particular issue.
Okay, counsel, so why didn't the government admit that portion of the exhibit instead of the whole entire exhibit, right? I mean, that makes perfect sense what you just said, right? But that's not what happened.
Your Honor, I would agree with, and the Army Corps found that it was admitted prematurely, and that it, at least anecdotally, I can say that normally it would be chopped up somewhat, and I think that's probably would have happened had it been a member's case. But we do have the Erickson presumption that the judge knows and follows the law. He said that he would give all the evidence the weight it deserves, which may very well be no weight.
But he said twice that it was admitted, right, that the entire exhibit was admitted.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I don't.
That it was 801 evidence, that the exhibit was 801 evidence.
That's right, Your Honor, and I'm not contesting that here today. He admitted it under, he said, I believe it was MRE 801 Delta.
But so if it's not actually 801 evidence, the entire video, then what do we make of that?
Well, I think you'd have to.
What weight is 801 evidence given?
Well, it's.
What weight does it do?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What weight does it do?
It gives substantive effect to all prior consistent statements under both Parts 1 and Part 2. Now, but we still must assume that the military judge is able to view that evidence and conclude for himself what was consistent and what was not. He saw and heard AH testify at trial, and to the extent that there was extraneous information, that he would be able to discard that information and give it no weight.
The government's position, as I understand it, is that this is a he said, well, it's not even a he said, she said, it's a she said case. And that therefore, any attempt to try and discredit her testimony gives the government, gives the judge carte blanche to let this stuff in and say, well, I'll do with it as I see fit. And the only thing we have to hang our hats on is the presumption that the judge knows what he's doing and follows the law. Is that the government's position?
Your Honor, it is not the government's position that if you cross-examine a complaining witness, every prior consistent statement is...
It seems to be the government's position in this case.
Given the defense counsel's strategy in this case, Your Honor, which was a broadside attack on her credibility, through the elicitation.
Well, I don't know what else defense counsel had to do.
Well,
that's neither here nor there.
Your Honor, this is not a criticism of defense counsel's representation in this case, but merely that this court has held in Morgan and McCaskey that they are the gatekeeper to the admission of prior consistent statements. And if you're going to structure a defense in this case that is going to just attack a witness's credibility, and that's a classic form of defense, I'll agree with that. But you need to build into your trial strategy the possibility that prior consistent statements are going to be admitted, and you're going to have to account for that as you prepare
well,
for trial.
Well, it appears that prior consistent statements were indeed admitted, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So then all we have to hang our hat on is the judge knowing what he's doing. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly part of it, Your Honor. And this was a judge alone trial.
Trial.
He stated he would give the evidence the weight it deserves, and we have the Erickson presumption that they know and follow the law absent clear evidence to the contrary. And furthermore, this court can affirm the judgment below on any basis supportable in the record. And the government would submit that the record as a whole manifestly supports this, the admission of Prosecution Exhibit 3 under both parts of 801 Delta 1 Bravo.
What about the issue of prejudice then? Or, I assume from your point of view, the lack thereof.
Correct, Your Honor. That we would submit there, that even if it was admitted, an error did not substantially influence the findings. And we have the testimony of AH who credibly recalled appellant's sexual assault. This is not a case like Frost where we have a child victim who is recanted at an official proceeding under Article 32. AH had maintained her allegations against appellant, notwithstanding the unsupportive environment fostered by her mother. The defense case, as I've stated many times already this morning, was an attack on her credibility, and the military judge's finder, in fact, was able to observe those attacks and find that they were insufficient. And turning to materiality and quality, I would submit that the, again, this was defense counsel acquiesced in the admission of Prosecution Exhibit 10, which was Dr. Thomas Taylor's written report that detailed AH's allegations of abuse. In some ways, it was more expansive than Prosecution Exhibit 3, in that she contained the detail about appellant penetrating her mouth with his finger. And so to the extent it was admitted an error, there was at least substantial overlap on facts of central importance.
Well,
to the
yeah, that's what I would like to ask you, as I ask counsel for the appellant. What's the effect of Thomas Taylor's, of all this stuff coming in under her rubric?
Your Honor, I would submit that it is... There is substantial overlap on facts of central importance with AH's testimony, Dr. Thomas Taylor's report, and Prosecution Exhibit 3. So even if you excise Prosecution Exhibit 3, the judge is still getting this the allegations of sexual abuse in two different forms.
What about the two statements that the appellant's counsel said were of primary concern to him? The statement to the effect that the mother said, don't go mess with the girls, and the other statement that you know, that, that he didn't want, she didn't want him around if the girls were there.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't read too much into those statements. I don't think she's messing around with the girl in the sense of don't go in there and abuse the girls, but I think that's an equally fair reason to take from that statement. But, again, we assume that to the extent that that was not consistent with her trial testimony and she didn't testify to that at trial, I think this court can assume that the military judge just discarded that.
Well, what if we take the opposite view? We take the military judge at his word, which is that the entire video was 801 evidence and therefore substantive evidence. Right, and so let's say he's in equipoise, like not even equipoise, but it's like, oh, maybe it's beyond reasonable doubt, maybe it's not, right? And then he hears that the mother of the daughter expressed words that could be construed as her knowledge or suspicion that he was going to mess with the girls, meaning sexually mess with them, which is exactly what his daughter or stepdaughter alleged.
Your Honor, well, it would have to substantially affect the military judge's findings in this case, and I think that statement, it's not a charge of uncharged misconduct. I don't think it's even some type of pernicious character evidence or propensity evidence of him assaulting other victims or even assaulting AH again. So to the extent it was somewhat harmful to appellant, I think it would be outweighed by the other Kerr factors in this case, particularly at a military judge alone trial.
Counsel, can you clarify a point that you made earlier? I just want to understand the government's position. Is it the government's interpretation? Maybe it's neither, but it sounds like there's two possible interpretations. One is when the judge admitted the entire video, he was essentially saying, well, I'm admitting it to the extent, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm admitting it to the extent that it contains 801 evidence, and so I won't consider any other part of it. Or I'm admitting everything in there, but I know that I'm not going to give a lot of weight to things that are lack credibility because they're hearsay or are not prior consistent statements. It sounded like earlier you were suggesting that when he admitted it, he was admitting it only to the extent that it contained 801 evidence and sort of implicitly saying that I'm not really admitting the whole thing. Is that the government's position?
No, Your Honor, and for the reason that built into the federal common law of these rehabilitative prior consistent statements, I think, is this notion that context and completeness matter. The principle of completeness, the opinion of JAS, Ellis, even Judge Cox's concurring opinion for this court in McCaskey, talk about when you impeach a witness with something they didn't say, that can, and then, as in this case, you use that omission to impugn the entire witness's credibility. It's important that the fact finder have a context and understanding of the tenor of that conversation. And in this case, the fact finder could, after hearing that impeachment by omission, somewhat reduce AH's credibility in their mind. But after watching the video and seeing that, well, this is an 11-year-old girl who's discussing with this law enforcement agent these awful things that have happened to her, and she was never asked the question about whether appellant ever put anything in her mouth. So the fact finder could conclude, well, the video, after I've watched it in context and I've seen the complete picture, it's really just a girl who didn't answer a question that she wasn't asked. So I think there's more to it than just
the follow-on questions that you were given that you gave. You said, is there anything you want to add? Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us?
Your Honor, those questions were asked, but this...
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the government's position is this, which is if you impugn a witness's credibility by traditional cross-examination methods, then anything that they've said, right, that is consistent with what other things that they said, even if it's not the thing that was challenged, is fair game.
No, that's not the government's position, Your Honor.
And that's
not
what you just said, though.
Well, Your Honor, I would...
Which is, her credibility was impugned by the things that she didn't say, and so therefore they could put in the whole video so they could see that she wasn't asked those specific questions.
Your Honor, her credibility was impugned in a number of ways in this case. Inconsistencies...
You have to answer my question, which is based on what you just said.
I think that's one reason it could be admissible in this case, Your Honor. But you've talked about other forms of cross-examination. A classic form of cross-examination is showing prior bad acts, showing convictions, bad character for truthfulness. I think that the treatises and the district court cases that I've read suggest that those would not open the door under Part 2 of the rule, because introducing a prior consistent statement after a witness has been impeached by a prior conviction, it doesn't rebut that. It doesn't fortify that impeachment method at the line of attack
But how is what you're saying consistent with the common law rule that you have to connect the impeachable thing with the consistent statement, with the prior consistent statement? Because the things that you're talking about are not tied directly at all to the specific things that she was impeached about.
Well, she was impeached for numerous reasons in this case, Your Honor, and that all set up defense counsel's ultimate argument that this is just a girl who keeps concocting new versions of the story, and that's the defense counsel's words, keeps fabricating new versions of the story and tries to support it. On the stand, she once again makes up a new story.
So this, true or not true, right, that then if she said something at trial, right, and he said that the defense counsel suggested that that was like a lie or that she had forgotten to bring it up before, right, you could bring in a prior consistent statement that said that, in fact, she had said the exact same thing on a prior occasion.
I think that's exactly what the rule is intended to encompass, Your Honor, under Part 2. That's one of the enumerated bases for admission under Part 2 is impeachment by a prior inconsistent statement. But I think the inconsistent statement would have to be something of significance to the trial. It couldn't be, well, my tent was red, but I testified earlier it was green. That has nothing to do with the charge misconduct in the case. So something like that on a tangential basis, I don't think it would survive 403, which is really baked into this whole analysis. I don't think the standard under MRE 801 is a very high standard, but it still must pass through the rigor of 403 balancing. And that is where I believe a defense counsel could argue to keep these damaging prior consistent statements out if they're the probative value was substantially outweighed by the prejudice. And that's something the committee notes indicate, that it still must pass through the rigor of 403.
So, Captain Jones, if you would, please, could you articulate what you think the holding of this court should be that would address Judge Ryan's concerns about opening the door? What should we be holding here to make it clear that everything doesn't come in simply by an attack on credibility, and then apply the holding that you think we should come up with to your specific case?
Your Honor, number one, that Part 2 doesn't permit carte blanche authority to admit prior consistent statements. That's not something the government's advancing today.
Okay, can you state that in the affirmative now? You've just stated,
yes, Your Honor.
Cannot do. Can you please?
Understood, Your Honor. That once a witness's credibility has been attacked, the government, and could be through inconsistent statements, it could be through faulty memory, the government is able to rehabilitate and fortify at that point of attack. And it has to meet, the rehabilitation must meet the method of impeachment. So if it is a full-scale broadside attack on a witness's credibility to include the facts of central importance to the court-martial, which was the case here, it may open the door to admit the prior consistent statement to talk about those facts. When, how many times the abuse occurred, where it occurred, what parts of her body he touched, all of those she was cross-examined on in this case and was suggested to be either recently fabricating or that she just couldn't remember what story she had told.
But getting back to a concern that the Chief Judge raised, I mean, isn't that what these cases are always going to be about, is attacking, if it's a she-said case, aren't all these cases going to be attacking the credibility of the witness? Yeah. And if that's the case, then why are we not wandering into the area of concern expressed by Judge Ryan about all these collateral issues coming in? I'm unclear where you're setting up the divider here to address the concerns raised by Judge Ryan.
Your Honor, it may be part of a case, but it's attacks on a witness's credibility are not always part of the case, or there could be attacks on a credibility that do not trigger MRE 801 Delta 1 Bravo 2. And this has been the law of the federal circuits for many years at this point. They've allowed rehabilitative statements to come in, and they've developed this federal common law, and certain things, according to the treatises that I've studied, just do not trigger it. Prior bad character for truthfulness, prior convictions, prior bad acts, those things are generally held not to trigger it. Or perhaps an appellant could choose to testify and counter the victim's version of events, and the defense counsel could argue to the fact finder they should credit his version of events.
But the rule is about prior consistent statements, right? Meaning, I think, from my perspective, that what the witness is testifying to in court today is consistent with what the person testified about before. And it's that statement that was challenged, right? Because you're rehabilitating. It's not on the thing that is alleged to be untrue, just any anything that they say?
No, not anything, Your Honor. She was specifically impeached and charged with falsifying at trial, and I haven't even talked about Part 1, but she was charged with either inconsistencies in how she had described these events, and that all setting up defense counsel's closing argument that this never happened, she just can't remember what she's told other people. So she's a liar. She's never told the same story twice. That was what defense counsel wanted the fact finder to believe.
Then the statements that she made before that were consistent with what she said at trial were admissible.
Correct, Your Honor, in this case.
You're saying that the entire statement was admissible because it showed the whole interview and that she wasn't asked these questions and blah, blah, blah.
Your Honor, I think defense took a multi-layered approach here, okay? If there... The principle of completeness, I think, has been embedded within the rehabilitative prior consistent statements for impeachments by omissions, but let's assume the impeachment by omission didn't even happen in this case. I think defense counsel's attacks on her credibility for her prior inconsistent statements alone would have triggered the applicability of Part 2 in this case.
The entire statement?
Excluding the omissions, I think it would just be the facts of central importance. You know, how many times it occurred, when, how, and how many times the sexual abuse occurred. So yes, the key issues in the court martial,
and of course we don't know what he considered, except for the presumption that he knows what he's doing.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct. They're assumed to know and follow the law.
That's the whole point.
And he said he would give all the evidence the weight
it
deserved.
He said he would give the weight it deserved. Which may be nothing.
Maybe nothing. That's correct, Chief Judge Stuckey.
All right.
There are no further questions of the court.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
To please the court, Your Honors, the government counsel's argument seems to basically be narrowed down to two things, that a military judge who didn't know what he was doing in this particular circumstance knew what he was doing in this particular circumstance. He didn't know what he was doing when he admitted evidence erroneously without having reviewed it, but he knew what he was doing when he said that he would give it the weight that it was considered, that it deserved, and that we should extrapolate from that, that he would not give it the weight of hearsay evidence as opposed to the substantive evidence that the rule requires. The government's second argument seems to be, as it relates to the prejudice prong, and Judge Ryan, I will address your question on prejudice in just a moment, but as it relates to the prejudice prong, that evidence that the government spent an extensive amount of time litigating admissibility of was really completely irrelevant. Both of those cannot be true, Your Honors. Judge Stuckey, I think you've raised a very important question, which is what in the world else is a defense counsel supposed to do in a circumstance such as this? No matter how the government slices it, if you adopt the government's position, any time that an alleged victim is cross-examined, everything that she said could come in. And theoretically, if she told 10 people the week before trial, my stepdad's going on trial because he sexually molested me, that would all be admissible. Because that rehabilitates her after the defense counsel attacks her on the grounds that her stepfather did not sexually assault her. Chief Judge, I want to address one more question of yours before I move on to the prejudice prong. When you asked about Dr., and I'm just calling her Dr. T.T. because
yeah.
I'm sure that'll help everybody. When you were asking about Dr. T.T.'s testimony, I would argue that this evidence served as nothing more than bolstering of Dr. T.T.'s evidence. So now we get down to the prejudice problem.
Yep. Oh. The problematic evidence served as bolstering of T.T.
Yes, sir.
And I keep thinking of the English comedian with the gappy teeth.
I keep thinking of the belt manufacturer Tom Taylor because my wife got me one for Christmas. So
okay.
That's how I got distracted.
Okay.
Your Honor, there were many details that were neither consistent nor inconsistent because they were not addressed at trial. I have addressed two of them, but Judge Meggs, I wanted to get back to one of the questions you asked. I addressed the information, the testimony, or the statement, rather, in the CID report, the CID interview, about the zipper and about the statement to A.H. There were two others that were extremely problematic. One of them, Judge Meggs, is that there was no testimony about what would happen if she tried to push the the appellant's hand away. But A.H. told CID this elaborate story of she watches Criminal Minds, which I had to Google because I didn't know what it was, but it was apparently a popular crime show, and she watched Criminal Minds and learned that he might figure out what she was doing and report him. That evidence or that statement is only in the CID report. It's not in Dr. T.T.'s testimony, and it is not in her testimony at trial. There was no testimony at trial about what the school counselor said, only that she reported it and nothing was done. A.H. told CID that when she told the school counselor that her mother did nothing about the allegation and let A.H. decide what would happen, the school counselor responded that her mother was wrong. That evidence was not admitted at trial. There was no testimony about these alleged text messages between A.H. and appellant's mom, which was all in the CID statement and, again, presumably substantively admitted. As it relates to prejudice, the government case was extremely weak. There was no physical evidence, and notably, A.H. refused a genital exam. The only evidence was A.H.'s allegation, and we were talking about a young lady whose mother and grandfather, both step-grandfather, both said that she was untruthful. The strength of the defense case, conversely, was quite strong. A.H.'s claim that she reported the abuse to a school counselor was refuted by that school counselor. A.H.'s testimony was inconsistent with that of other witnesses, including the government witnesses. And that's her testimony to B.M. that the assault happened in a room, and that she told B.M. that the appellant had dragged her from a vehicle. She told H.B. that she had been assaulted in her room. B.T. said that A.H. made the disclosure while they were both in middle school, which is not what A.H. testified to at trial. And clearly, A.H. had a motive to fabricate. The materiality and quality of the improperly admitted evidence was substantial. It went to the heart of the matter, which is whether or not the appellant committed the charged offenses. The video was nearly 2 hours long, and the consistent statements were not rehabilitative, and so allowing them bolstered her testimony through repetition. Excuse me. Subject to any further questions from the court, I would like to briefly conclude, Chief Judge. The statements were neither consistent nor inconsistent were hearsay but permitted the government to bolster. They provided additional details about the alleged assault and the improper character evidence painting the appellant in a bad light. For all the reasons stated, this court should rule that the admissibility of the entire video was error, that error was prejudicial, and it should reverse the appellant's conviction. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. And the court stands in recess pending further order of the court.
Merry Christmas
to all. And a Happy New Year.